So let me, I just want to make sure of time. We don't have to be to the president's till 4:30, so I have enough time, I think, for my talk. Let me begin with just a few words of thanks. First to Iriza, and congratulations to Iriza on 30 years, and to my dear friend Albert Benveniste for organizing this, and of course to the University of Rennes for the great honor, and congratulations to David. And thank you to our friends who came from quite a distance to be here for this. I'm not going to say more thanks at the moment. I will, in fact, say some more things in two different media later on. At the end of this lecture, it will be in PowerPoint, but it will be displaying primarily, I'll be exploiting primarily the talents of my wife, and you can figure out which part is hers. And the other media I will use will be over at the Présidence, and that media will be bad French. Okay, what I'm going to do today is to start off by giving you a picture of a line of research that started back in 1988 when I had my sabbatical here, invited by Albert and Michel. And the question that Albert and Michel posed at that point, wavelets were all of a sudden becoming hot. They were being proposed for everything from compression of signals to making better foie gras. And the question was, what were they really good for, and what did they mean in terms of statistical signal processing? And the more specific question we asked was, what does optimal inference mean and look like for multi-resolution models, whatever they are? And the answer that we gave was to look at stochastic models defined in multi-resolution trees. So these are pyramidal structures where you have random variables or vectors at each node, and where the statistical structure is very simple, conditioned on the value at a particular node. Each of the descendant subtrees and the rest of the entire tree are all conditionally independent. So it's a very nice collection of class of models, and it led to a lot of things. I'll make a comment here, which is that there are some titles here which I'm not going to explain. They're mostly American slang. You can figure them out for yourselves. There will be an exam tomorrow. But let me describe a few of the things that we did in exploiting this class of models. They lead to extremely fast and scalable algorithms that basically involve propagating statistics up and down and throughout the tree. And there are a variety of things one can do. The first that Albert and Michel and I did was to look at generalizations, the celebrated Levinson algorithms, which had some interesting twists. One of my PhD students came over with us to France, and Ken Chow and Albert and I developed a generalization of Kalman filters and Rauschenberg-Schriebel smoothers. The calculation of likelihoods was done by another student, Mark Lutkin, who spent time at IRIZA the summer after my sabbatical. And there were a variety of other things we did. The control roots came back, so there were a lot of work on system theory, Riccati equations, multi-resolution system theory, excuse me, that involved Ken Chow, Albert, me, and another of my former students, Rami Nukucha from Roquencourt. Mark did some work, and I'll talk about this a little bit more later on. Then there was work on stochastic realization theory and the concept of internal models, something that for state space models is quite important. That work was done by two students, Mike Daniel and Bill Irving, and for a reason I can't explain, neither of them ever visited IRIZA. Finally, a little bit later, Khalid Daoudi, who up until recently, I think, was at INRIA Nancy, who spent 2 years with us, had an insight that really closed the loop on what Albert and Michel originally stated for our program, which is how you tie together wavelets into this setting. A very ingenious idea that he had that allowed us to understand how to put wavelets into this framework. And a variety of other results. These are results on max entropy covariance extension using some fairly nice graph theory that were done by one of my students, Austin Frack, me, and a colleague that some of you know, Hanoch Levary. And there are a variety of applications. And I'm not going to talk about all of these. Some of these in computer vision, Patrick Perez and Patrick Boutemi know well. A variety of others in geophysics, where it's had a lot of impact. Some of which I've been involved with, and some of which others have been involved with, for reasons that I can't begin to explain to you. But let me give you an example of the kind of thing that we did. This is work done by part of the ocean from the deviation of sea level from the geoid to an accuracy of 5 centimeters. There are places in the ocean where you do not know the geoid to 10 meters, near things like the Hawaiian almost islands or the Aleutians. So what we did was, in fact, to look at statistically significant anomalies, differences between the residuals in our measurements and what we expected from the variances. And what are overlaid here are plots of those overlaid on bathymetry, the bottom topography of the ocean. We're able to use this, and together with the bathymetry, then not only to estimate sea level, but also to do a better job of estimating gravity. Unfortunately, these models on trees, while having great strengths, also have some limitations. And the limitations is the fact that the graphs don't have loops. And so a problem is you may have two nodes that are very close to each other physically, but are connected through the tree at quite a distance on the tree. So if I condition on that node, these two nodes are conditionally independent, which means that node carries the entire responsibility for the correlation between these nodes. And that can lead to either high dimensionality or it can lead to artifacts. Well, our program led to three different ways to think about this. The first was to ignore it. And so this was some work that probably the best piece of work on this was Mark Lutkin's work on problems of optical flow, where our statement was, in many applications, you're really only interested in estimating something at a coarser resolution. So if there are artifacts at fine resolution, that's fine, because anything you display at the finer scale is an artifact. It's only the coarser scale things that matter. The next thing we did was cheat. And there are two types of cheating. One is real cheating. That's taking several trees, running the algorithms, and shifting them slightly so you get rid of the artifact effects. And you'll see pictures of that soon. That was what was done in the oceanography work. The other was a bit more clever, was to say the problem is that these two points are on opposite sides of the tree. What if the nodes that they represent, what they represent physically, represent overlapping portions of space? Now, one has to work hard to make that precise. But you can, in fact, do it and come up with an algorithm that overcomes that difficulty somewhat. And that's something that led to the fact that finally we said we were going to have to put the loops in. We were going to have to put loops in. And the issue was, what could we do in this field? And this is the field that's played in by all sorts of other groups of people. Statistical physicists working on things such as Ising models have worked on these types of distributions for a long time. And you'll find these in AI under names such as belief networks and the like. So here's a little bit of graphical models for those of you who are not familiar with them. So the idea is I have a graph with a set of vertices and edges. Which is completely connected. Every pair of vertices in that set has an edge between them. The notion of Markovianity for a graphical model is very simple. given any set of nodes that separates the graph into disconnected components, conditioned on the values along that set, the other parts are conditionally independent. So it's a very nice, simple notion. And Hammersley and Clifford came up with a sufficient and almost necessary condition for that to occur, which says that the probability distribution for all of the variables on the entire graph has to be factorable as a product of factors, each of which is a function of the variables on a clique. Okay, so that's the form of this. There are a few comments I want to make about this. Unless you're dealing with a graph in which there aren't loops, those factors do not correspond to marginal probabilities on groups of nodes. Very important fact, they're just implicit specifications of these things. The second is that there's a proportionality constant here. And there's typically something written here as a factor. It's usually written as 1 over z, something that Roger didn't talk about but was on his slide when he talked about Boltzmann distributions yesterday, which is in physics known as a partition function. And it's exceedingly important for a variety of reasons. Another is that often these functions are written not in this form, but as the exponential of functions. So that, in fact, what the distribution looks like is an exponential of a weighted sum of functions defined at over various cliques in the graph. And Steve talked a little bit about exponential models. Those are a class of exponential models defined over the graph. In general, you need to consider cliques of arbitrary size. I'm going to simplify for this discussion and assume that the only functions that are non-zero here involve pairwise potential. So they only involve pairs of nodes connected by an edge. And you can, there's a rich class which one can always get by aggregating nodes. All of this generalizes if one wants to use hypergraphs and hypertrees. Well, the objectives that one has in statistical inference for models like this, well, there's several. One of them is you'd like to get your hands on what I'll call the estimation problem, the probability distribution at each node on the graph. That's what we did in the oceanography problem. We got that probability distribution. You might also like to look at an optimization problem, which is to get the global peak of the entire probability distribution. Both of those are very hard problems for graphs in general. What's interesting for trees, and it's interesting to look at this to understand what algorithms do on trees, is they basically rewrite the distribution. And so again, this is done for the case of where we have pairwise potentials. They write it in a form that might not look familiar until you think about standard Markov chains. So if I have a Markov chain, we know we can write it as an initial distribution times a transition distribution times a transition distribution, et cetera. I can also write it as a final distribution times a transition, transition going backwards. Or I can write it as a distribution at the center point and then conditional distributions going in opposite directions. This is basically a non-directional version of that. You can get all of those from that form of the distribution. This is basically what algorithms compute. For optimization, what may be a little less known is that the joint probability can also be written as something proportional to a product of factors, so it looks very similar, where each of these factors is what's known as a max marginal. So p bar of xs, for every value of xs, you maximize over all the other nodes on the graph. And so it gives you locally a function that, if you can optimize over xs, will give you the xs contribution to the overall global optimum. Algorithms that do this on trees, for the estimation problem, calculating marginals, there are algorithms which have a very important word that goes with them, which is message passing algorithms. And they correspond to passing messages along edges in the graph. So again, this is for trees. There are two sweep algorithms, ones that start at the leaf nodes, propagate information up to the top, and then propagate information back down. Those are generalizations of things like Kalman filters and smoothers. There also are examples of algorithms which are completely direction-free. And these are what are known as belief propagation algorithms or the sum product algorithm. initially talked about by Uta Perl. You now find them everywhere, for example, in the discussion of low-density parity codes or turbo codes. Some product algorithms appear. And the way to think about this is at every node, in order to compute the probability, I need whatever local evidence, whatever local potential, that's the word that I'll use for these functions that make up the factors in my probability distribution. I'll need the local potential, and then I'll need likelihood functions from all of the different parts of the trees. And you can view those likelihood functions as different messages. What's interesting is the messages, because of the tree structure, have a recursive relationship to them, so you have a set of fixed point equations that you try to solve. So what happens is each node sits there, it passes messages from to its neighbors, it gets messages from its neighbors. After it has messages, it then does some computation, passes messages again. After k steps, it has information from a radius k around itself. And so that's another form of these algorithms. For the optimization problem, which is maximum a posteriori estimation, there is a two-sweep algorithm, which is the generalization of dynamic programming, or Viterbi. And there also is a max product algorithm that does something to calculate the max marginals, exactly the way that I talked about for the message passing algorithm for the sum product algorithm. All right, so what do people do when there are loops? The thing that's been done a lot is to say, well, gee, let's take a look at those direction-free algorithms that just pass messages. They don't need to know global structure of the graph. They're happy. They're just passing messages. And that leads to easily, just directly generalizes to an algorithm. So why not just use that algorithm? Well, there are a variety of limits to that. It basically fuses information based on an assumption of conditional independence. On a tree, the information on likelihoods I'm getting from the different sides are conditionally independent. However, if there are loops, that's not true. And what I refer to this as, and I'll now give you a little bit of a variation on an American child story, which is the Chicken Little story, which is Chicken Little gets hit on the head by a nut, and he goes and tells Goosey Lucy the sky is falling. Goosey Lucy tells Henny Penny, who tells Lucky Ducky, who tells Chicken Little, who says, I knew I was right. And the point is that information is propagating around the loop. And therefore, you end up with either overconfidence. Sometimes you can end up with lack of convergence if there are contradictory pieces of information, what are known as frustrated potentials. And so people have applied these algorithms for a while, and many times they work well. For a long time, people didn't know why, didn't know when, didn't know a whole lot. They were just happy they had an algorithm. For an NP-hard problem, sometimes it did something good. All right, well, what have we done? We've done some work on analyzing those, and I'll talk a little bit about that. We've also done some things trying to exploit what we know about trees. And this is some work done by two of my students, Martin Wainwright, who some of you know, and Eric Sutterth, who visited here, I think back in June. This was Eric's master's thesis. And so this is a simple picture. It'll give you an idea of the problem with trees. So this is an image of the covariance matrix of a time series. So it's a stationary time series, a piece of it. I'm showing you the covariance. It's not Markovian. And what you'd like to be able to do is to realize that by a tree model. So the idea is the variables at the finest scale here represent your approximation to the stochastic process you're trying to estimate. Everything above it is a hidden variable introduced to capture as close as possible the statistical structure that you're trying to capture. So in fact, you get something that has the best you can do, minimizing Kolblak-Leibler divergence, is a covariance that looks like this. And so you can see the artifacts in the covariance due to the fact that there are nodes right here, and right here that are very close together but are very far apart. And unless you put high-dimensional variables at those nodes, you're going to have troubles. Well, that suggests the idea, why don't I put in a couple of other nodes? So now I have something that's got a few loops, but in fact, it's still pretty close to a tree. And what you end up with are covariances. The images aren't really, this is virtually indistinguishable from this. And this leads to algorithms that are very fast because there aren't many edges you need to cut in this guy here to extract a tree. And so you can end up with algorithms that cut different sets of edges and do iterations, a variation of something known as Richardson's method. You can get out of this the estimates and also the covariances. The computations scale well as long as the rank of the matrix that corresponds to the edges that you're cutting is low rank. So this works very well for things that are near trees. Still not enough. There are lots of graphs that have what is known as high tree width, where in fact these things will not work that well. Some other things that we've been doing, and this is work of Martin Wainwright, and I'll just spend a couple of minutes on it, mostly because Martin did some remarkable things. What Martin started out doing was saying, well, gee, I've got this entire distribution, which unfortunately is over a graph with loops. Well, a graph with loops has many embedded acyclic graphs. Let me take one of them. Let me take all the terms that correspond to the edges that aren't in that tree. Take those out. The rest of it looks like a nice distribution defined over a tree. Let me, in fact, run belief propagation to, in fact, factor it. Aha, then let me say, okay, I'm going to use a different tree. I'm going to take some of the terms away from here, from the first side of this thing. I think this thing's working, but I'm not sure you can see it. From the product terms, and put in some of the other terms. Go to a different tree. And iterate back and forth. It turns out that algorithm has exactly the same fixed points as belief propagation. The question, of course, first question is, are there fixed points? And the fixed points satisfy something very interesting. Basically, this form that we have here corresponds to a direction-free version of Chapman-Kolmogorov equation for Markov chains. And what these quantities, which I've used the symbol T for, which are pseudo-marginals, they aren't the right marginals exactly because of Chicken Little. What happens is all the fixed points have to be places where these T's satisfy Chapman-Kolmogorov on every embedded acyclic structure in the graph. And there are a lot. So one of you be skeptical that any fixed points exist, they always exist. And Martin, in fact, was able to characterize them, and I'll say a few more words about that. What Martin was also able to do here was to come up with bounds on that partition function, actually the logarithm of that partition function. So remember, the probability density, if I write it as exponentials of sums of functions, I can think of breaking up those functions into terms over different trees. In fact, I can take convex combinations of distributions over trees. Well, this partition function turns out to be a convex function of the weights in those distributions. So using convexity, you can try to optimize those weights over all possible spanning trees within the graph. Sounds hard because there are a lot of spanning trees. Using duality, you come up with a very nice algorithm that's polynomial that allows you, in fact, to do that optimization and come up with the tightest bounds currently known on the errors in what belief propagation converges to, assuming it converges. Martin also did the same thing for the optimization problem. Here you're trying to optimize a cost function which is also convex. And Martin came up with a stunning, in my opinion, a stunning result here, which was to say, I'm going to do the same thing. I'm going to optimize, run algorithms on different trees. I'm going to break up the distribution into a convex combination of terms in this exponential corresponding to different trees. And I'm going to run them, came up with a concept of tree agreement. And he said, I'm going to optimize the bound, make it as tight as I possibly can. What's interesting is that with the exception of a condition that I'll explain in a minute, that bound is tight. So in fact, Martin came up with an algorithm that in fact solves exactly this combinatorial optimization problem. Obviously, for hard problems buried in that, it's going to have exponential time to converge. But in fact, it's a stunning algorithm that he came up with. Martin also pointed out the fact that there are problems with this representation. And it also explains some things about the differences between trees and non-trees. Imagine I have two nodes, each with a binary variable and an edge between them. And suppose I have potentials that say, okay, it's equally likely and very likely that one of them, this one's a zero and this one's a one, or this one's a zero and this one's a one. And it's also equally likely, but unlikely, that they're both zeros or they're both ones. So if you think about the max marginal from the point of view of node one, it doesn't matter if it chooses a zero or a one, because if the other one chooses the other value, that's perfectly fine. You get the same value for maximizing the distribution. Well, if they do it independently, there's a problem. But we know how to solve that for problems like that. It's called the cost to go. Dynamic programming. One of the nodes makes a decision, the other then knows about that decision and can in fact choose the right value. Now imagine a graph with three nodes with exactly the same kinds of potentials between them. So each pair of nodes wants to have different values between 0 and 1. Okay. There's no way that those max marginals provide you with anything that provides a solution to that problem. But if that very special condition, which is basically the fact that you want to have a unique maximum for those marginals at each node, if there's a unique maximum for these max marginals, then in fact Martin's algorithm yields the optimal solution. Okay, so what does any of this have to do with distributed fusion and sensor networks? Now, the first point is that we are talking about passing messages and fusing information, although from the point of view of some of the things you heard in the last talk yesterday, the algorithm does some things that are naive in terms of the assumptions of sensor networks. Passing messages is great for belief propagation. You pass lots of messages. Of course, it uses power in sensors, which is a problem. It also doesn't take advantage of much computation at individual nodes. Well, you may have computational power at nodes. You might want to do more. That said, it's an interesting start to thinking about these algorithms. And so what we began to do is to look at, starting from the point of view of message passing algorithms, try to understand what kinds of questions came up when we started thinking about sensor networks and how these led to new results for sensor networks and, interestingly, and a surprise to all of us, I think, to new results back for graphical models. So here's a first application. This was some work done by Alex Eiler, a PhD student who finished relatively recently. And it's a problem of sensor localization. So you have a network of sensors that are thrown down there. Some of them may have GPS, so they have some idea where they are. And think of them as being acoustic sensors. So each one can send out a little ping. And the sensors that are close enough will hear it. And assuming that their clocks are synchronized, or at least they're close, they can get an estimate of distance between pairs of nodes. Maybe you have little sensor arrays, in which case they also want to be able to estimate angular orientation of these sensors. So the unknowns at each node might be the location of the sensor. It might be the orientation of the sensor if you have little arrays, and it might be a time offset between all of the sensors. The kinds of sources of information, you may have prior potentials on individual nodes corresponding to GPS on a sensor, for example. Or maybe you knew you dropped your sensors in California and not in Bordeaux, so you know a little bit about location. Two things. You also have these measurements, which are measurements between pairs of nodes. See if I can get this to show. It's not going to show. So you have measurements between pairs of nodes. That doesn't necessarily make this problem well posed. If you look at that sensor up in the upper left-hand corner, there, if all I'm getting is range information from the two nearest sensors, those are almost on the same place. So all I have, if I have no other information, is the fact that I live on a circle centered around where they're located. So I don't. It's quite an ill-conditioned problem. However, if I also know that the sensor on the other side doesn't hear me, that tells me something that can make the problem well posed. So in fact, the issue, you may be able to bring in some more complicated networks by bringing in some additional edges that make this problem well posed. Well, Alex looked at this problem the same time as Eric Sutterth was looking at a problem that he gave a lecture on here back in June. And what the two of them came up with was something interesting in its own right. And it dealt with the fact that if you took a look at the graphical model literature in terms of algorithms or packages that are out there, they were basically all developed for two cases. One in which the variables took values in discrete finite sets so that these likelihoods that I was sending were just a vector of numbers. Or they were Gaussian, so I'm only sending means and covariances, finite dimensional variables. Problem I just described, you're going to have probability distributions and likelihood functions of continuous variables. And what was available in the literature was worse than total surrender, in my opinion. Just arbitrarily, let's quantize the variables, discretize the variables, and turn a nice, for example, one-dimensional continuous variable problem into a combinatorially explosive problem. And that's where the world sat. What Eric and Alex came up with was something that's known as non-parametric belief propagation. Some of you have heard a bit about this when Eric talked here, but I'll go through the basic idea. It's closely related to particle filtering. And so the idea here is that belief propagation works for general graphs, and you get easily understood algorithms in terms of sending finite dimensional pieces of information for finite variables that take values in finite sets or for Gaussians. And it can deal with graphs such as ones that have loops in them. Of course, when it has loops, it has to take the messages from several places, which are likelihood functions, and multiply them together. Okay, so that's a fundamental thing that's different between the picture on the right. The picture on the right is for Markov chains. And for Markov chains, we can deal with, using nonlinear filtering, general potentials. What particle filtering is, if you're not familiar with it, is the idea that at every point in time, I assume that I have samples from the conditional distribution for my state at that time, given all of the data. I then have a transition distribution to the next time. So each of my current samples, I sample from that distribution to get a new sample. I then take my measurement, which provides me with likelihoods on each of these new samples, weights. I then, in fact, do some resampling in order to take into account the fact that I now have weighted particles, and I'm back to being able to do it again. The problem is that in the picture on the left, if I think about having particles come in representing approximations to messages, I'm multiplying them. And what does it mean to multiply two sets of particles? And the perspective that Eric and Alex had was to say, well, look, we're talking about sending something that basically is a probability distribution. So why don't I think of my particles as a non-parametric estimate of that probability density? The simplest thing to think about is that I'm going to put a little Gaussian kernel around each one of my samples. So each of my distributions now is a Gaussian sum. All right, that also has problems. But let's talk about where those problems come from. So this is what belief propagation looks like. So I've got a node XT, and we want to figure out the red arrow. What's the message it's going to send to XS? So what it does is it takes the messages from all of the other neighbors, other than the one it wants to send a message to. It multiplies those together. It takes whatever local information it has, this guy right here, multiplies it, and then puts this through the transition distribution, basically the potential to go from here to here. And that's what the likelihood function is that it sends to the other node. In the particle context, I need to draw a sample from the quantity in the first set of braces here, the product of the potential at the node and all of the other messages. That's a problem, because that's a product of a bunch of Gaussian sums, which has a growing number of terms in it. And so the issue is, how do I sample from this guy without coming into something that's combinatorially explosive? And the idea that Eric and Alex came up with is, I'd like to sample from that product without ever explicitly constructing it. And the real hard part of this is I need to solve the label selection problem. Which of the kernels from message one do I want to take? Which are the kernels from message two, et cetera? And if I can sample from that, then after I've chosen a sample from that, I just need to choose something from a particular Gaussian distribution. The issue is, how do I do that? And what Alex and Eric developed was a very clever way of not only doing important sampling, but doing something multi-resolution using k-dimensional trees. And I'll talk about that in a different context a bit more later, so let me defer talking about that. This has been applied to a variety of applications. Eric showed it applied to vision and tracking the motion of a hand, a fairly complicated model he had. Alex applied it to the sensor localization problem, and I'll talk about that a little bit more later. But this is also shown here that you can also apply it together with level set methods. Here the graph is very simple. Motion is periodic. But attached to each node, in fact, now is an entire level set curve. Into for sensor networks was the fact that we were going to need to deal with messages that involve continuous variables. The second was we had to deal with the fact that communications can be power costly, and you want, therefore, to limit the amount of communication. And so the objective is you'd like to provide each node with some decision rule that says, I don't have enough new to say, and so I'm not going to send my message. Of course, you also need to provide a way for the sensor that would have received that message. You need some protocol that says, what does it do if it doesn't get a message? Well, there's something very simple. This is a student, Lei Chen, who's been working on this. Is you don't send a message if the Kullback-Leibler divergence between the last message you sent and the new one is below some threshold. And a node, if it doesn't receive a message, uses the last one it received from that node. So it requires a little more memory, but these processors typically were underutilizing their power already. So this is an example of how this thing works, and I'm going to just let it run. There are interesting things that this algorithm does, which is nodes will shut down for a while until they get information from far away that, in fact, allow them to see that they have something new to say. So there's some adaptiveness in this. I want to say a word about what's behind this particular this example. This is an example that comes from a problem of data association corresponds to something like the correspondence problem in computer vision. So imagine I have a bunch of sensors, maybe a bunch of cameras, each of which are looking at a number of things, people, vehicles, whatever they're looking at in regions. And they have overlapping areas of seeing things. And so the issue is, which of the things that I see corresponds to which of the things that you see? Now, you'd like to have the nodes in the graph that corresponds to how you're sending messages correspond to the sensors. It makes sense, since those are the physical devices. If you just have the nodes be the sensors, you end up having a fairly dense graph because there may be some objects seen by multiple sensors. You end up with can end up with larger cliques. What Lei did was to, in fact, come up with automatically a way of coming up with a graph structure that has two different types of nodes. The little circles here correspond to sensors. The little squares correspond to groups of targets that are seen by multiple sensors. The state at the sensor nodes correspond to basically how you're going to break up your measurements into the sets that go with each of the connections that are here. So it's not quite a permutation, but hopefully each sensor doesn't see that many objects. And that's the whole idea of this. This raises an issue that I'll come back to very late in the talk, which is all of the circles there correspond to physical sensors. The squares don't. They're virtual nodes, which raises the issue of which sensor has those nodes. And if objects are moving, it raises the issue of how you hand those off from one sensor to the other. And handoff costs communication. And the issue is, what do you do with that? What was interesting when Lei was doing experiments here, and when Alex and Eric were doing experiments, is they found some really interesting experimental results in terms of how errors propagated. So in terms there were often threshold effects. If they had enough particles to represent messages, performance was great. If it fell off some below that, you'd end up with some catastrophically different performance. The same here in terms of the threshold for when you on Kullback-Leibler divergence for sending messages. So that was the state of affairs. The question is, we didn't have any theory. And so what was the theory that told you how the error in what message you were sending, the error in the message, leads to errors in the ultimate fusion? And this was some very nice work of Alex. And I'm not going to talk through this entire slide, but I want to give you an idea behind this. Suppose that M is the real message that ideally I'd like to send, and M hat is my approximation. Remember, they're both likelihood functions. So the ratio you can think of as a likelihood ratio. Could you tell the difference between the approximate message and the real one if the real one was sent? So it's a measure of error. In fact, what we typically have used, we also have a scaling factor that comes in this. Since these are likelihood functions, I can scale them up or down. We need to take care of that. We typically look at the log likelihood ratio, in fact, one half of that. So the metric that we've ended up using is this the soup of the difference in these errors, which basically tells you how far from being flat is this likelihood ratio for these two different measurements. It's a nice metric on the size of these errors, especially because it has two very important properties, one of which is it's subadditive. So if I have two messages, approximate messages that are multiplied together, the error with respect to this metric is less than or equal to the sum of the errors. We also have the fact that there's a contraction that goes on, which is the usual mixing in a Markov process. So there's a transition from one node to the other, and that provides a contraction in the messages. And so it provides a nice framework for thinking about analyzing these things. And so Alex has come up with the best known convergence results for belief propagation out of this, the tightest results for when it converges. He also, out of this, you come up with a picture of the fact there may be multiple fixed points, but they actually cluster together, and you can say something about how close together they are. He also, through this, came up with bounds on the sizes of the errors, how big the errors get as a function of the approximation error or the quantization error in your messages. And also a stochastic approximation as well, which you can think of as the same thing one does in digital filtering, where you assume the quantization from one time step to the other next is just white noise. So the kinds of results you get when you have fairly weak potentials, which corresponds to strong mixing, so errors contract a lot. Belief propagation, all the convergence results, certainly Alex's, show that things converge. The red line is the bound. The blue dashed line is the result that one gets from the approximation using white noise approximation. And the dots are various different simulations. Some of them are for what are known as supporting potentials. So these are ones where, like the Chicken Little problem, where things support each other, and one with frustrated potentials, where there's the possibility of contradiction. The one on the right is something for a problem where the potentials are much stronger, much less mixing. And in that case, the bound still does, the approximation still does very well. This one, nobody knows how to predict. Even our bound isn't good enough on showing that this one converges, although in this case it did. Okay, now we have all these particles. Another thing that Alex did was to say, well, gee, I've got to talk about how I communicate them. So the way I think about this is what I've just described to you is how an error in the message I send relates to the error in fusion. What you might also like to have is how the communication rate relates to the error in the message. Then you'd have a picture from communication rate to fusion performance. And so that was the agenda that Alex took on in these two pieces. This one now deals with the relationship between approximation and communication rate. And so the idea here is I've got a bunch of particles I want to send, which all are samples, IID samples, from this probability distribution, this message I'm trying to send. So what I'm really trying to transmit is that probability distribution, not the individual samples. If I thought I really wanted to transmit this guy, I know what the expected cost is that I need to get in terms of the amount of bits I'm going to need. But here it doesn't matter what order you send them in, so I'm going to get an n factorial saving here. But in addition, I can do something else that reduces entropy even farther. Now, the receiver doesn't know the probability distribution of the samples. Of course, that is what I'm trying to communicate to him, is that distribution. But if you set up protocols in particular ways, you can do things quite well. So for example, for a 1D variable, what I could do is to say, look, I'm going to send you first the smallest value. Okay, then I know everything else is bigger than it. Next, I'm going to send you the largest value. So now I've got a bound. I'm reducing entropy at each step. And so, in fact, you can come up with coding algorithms that approach, never equal, but approach what you would be able to do if, in fact, you knew the probability density at the receiver, which is, of course, what the receiver is trying to learn. And so the picture that Alex used in multiple dimensions used these KD trees. So this is this idea of how you organize particles. And it's a way of trying to collect them together. And so what you want to think about is along each, if I have an n-dimensional state at each node, I'm going to do this along each dimension. I'm going to cluster the variables at multiple resolutions. So at the coarsest, I'll have all the variables at a single resolution, and I'll cache them statistics, a mean and a covariance. And I'll break that up. And of course, going from here to the left and here to the right, that's kind of like saying the next one's bigger or the next one's smaller. So I can do something to reduce entropy in doing that coding. What's interesting here is every cut through this tree is an approximation to the message. I could send the coarsest one, that's an approximation, or I could send these two, or I could send this one and these two, or this one and these two. What's interesting is that it's very easy to go back and calculate, A, the error in each of these approximations, and B, the communication cost in every single one of those trees. And you therefore can optimize any problem you want. Set the communication rate that you want to have and come up with the distribution with the smallest error. Set the error that you want in the distribution, come up with the least bits that need to be communicated. And this is an example. I'm not going to go through all of this on that sensor localization problem, and it's interesting to see how this thing adapts. So initially a sensor maybe gets one measurement from one other sensor, so it knows that it lives on a circle. That's a pretty strange distribution. It's probably going to need a few particles. Then it gets another one. So now I've got two circles that intersect. I have a bimodal distribution. It probably needs a couple of modes. After a while, however, it's only going to need one when it's got itself localized well enough. So you end up with algorithms that can automatically adjust the communication rate depending upon the structure of the probability distribution. Okay. All right. So we then took a look at a slightly different problem. So let me talk a bit about this. And I apologize for this. I know that I was supposed to give a talk in English, and I apologize for using a French word in my talk. This is some work that is being done right now that's trying to bring together two lines of research. One of those is decentralized detection. So this is a field in decentralized control that's existed for a number of years, and it died. At least it's died several deaths. And one of the reasons was they were really looking for optimal solutions to problems that are exponentially hard. I mean, there are very simple examples developed by very famous people, Hans Witzenhausen, which we still don't know what the optimal solutions are. Very simple problems here. So this is something that died fairly early. On the other hand, we have message passing algorithms for graphical models, also NP-hard, but they've got this belief propagation algorithm, and they're happy. I mean, this algorithm doesn't do the right thing exactly, but they're happy. It's an algorithm, it sometimes works, and there are a lot of people who've worked hard on coming up with conditions when it does. What's the rapprochement between those? And so the idea is that we're really starting to explore now is that when communication constraints exist and when there are both local and global objectives in your network, so everybody has something they're responsible for, you have to come up with rules for these things to organize. And that uses communication. You're basically establishing what I refer to as a fusion protocol. Every node needs to know how to interpret the bits it's going to get, but those bits depend upon the decision rules at other nodes. And a big issue is how do we avoid the traps of optimality in this setting. But let me talk about a tractable case. I think I'll put all of these things up. So this is a problem which we in fact have a tree. So you have a directed set of nodes, which represent sensors. So it's something where everybody has his own decision to make, and he's also going to communicate to his boss, who's going to make another decision. Each of the nodes gets its own measurement of part of the overall state, and the overall cost is a sum of a bunch of costs. So you receive messages from your parents, and you send them to your children, and the cost is a sum of these costs incurred by each of the nodes. And each node has a local model. So what you want to think of is the prototypical example is a graphical model that has the same structure as your sensor network. And so each node is able, in fact, to communicate along that path. And the issue is, well, how do I solve this problem? This one's pretty easy to solve, at least if you use person-by-person optimality. So if you're not familiar with person-by-person optimality, it's a set of control laws for all of these nodes, all of these members of the team, such that if all of the other nodes keep their decision rules fixed and I try to optimize mine, I won't change it. So it's in some sense a local, it's an optimum in terms of the fact that everybody is happy given that everybody else is fixed. And what's interesting here is the optimization algorithm is itself a message passing algorithm. So each optimization step, what has to happen is each node needs a measurement model. How do I interpret the bits coming from my parents? All right, that depends on their decision rules. So there's a belief propagation step that goes forward to provide that. And it needs a cost to go. It's not a belief propagation, but something that tells it something about the impact of whatever decision it makes, not only on its own cost, but the upstream costs. And so this has a nice structure. You can talk about a Gauss-Seidel algorithm, which in fact monotonically decreases the cost, or a Jacobi algorithm, which like the asynchronous version of belief propagation where everybody sends messages, may or may not converge, but has the same fixed points. Well, what happens with more general networks? We'll let you know. What we do know is the following. What you really are talking about doing is you're designing decision rules corresponds. You have a graphical model that consists of three things. Whatever the underlying phenomenon is, the sensor network, and it's only the things in the communication paths and the decision rules that we get to play with, and the cost structure. And what's interesting here is that there are non-trivial issues in how you specify globally compatible rules. If my decision depends on your decision and your decision depends on my decision, you have issues of deadlock. That's exactly what Hammersley and Clifford solve by coming up with an implicit specification of the overall decision rule. So we start off with problems where we think of our rules as randomized rules, and we're specifying the potentials in a probability distribution. Optimization, in fact, calculating the cost, we know is going to be hard. We're going to have to come up with approximations. So we're started on this path. We're not there yet. Okay, let me blank this for a minute to explain something very quickly. There is a way to take any graphical model and turn it into a tree model. What I can do is to think of a two-dimensional grid. If I condition on the values right down the middle, the two sides are conditionally independent. That's a little tree. Take all those values, stick it at the top, these two sides and the other, and then just keep doing that. Problem with that is that's a very high dimensional variable at the top. Therefore, I need to approximate its distribution. The problem is, I can't calculate its distribution to approximate it. That's the whole thing I want to try to get my hands on. What do I do? Well, this is actually something that Mark Lipkin did in a very special class of problems where you could do it. But another student, Jason Johnson, who's working on in the group right now, came up with a very different idea. He says, let's start at the bottom. And so let me explain, looking at this picture over here. So there are nodes inside this cavity here. But conditioned on the values of these nodes here, everything that goes on inside and outside are independent. So really all I'd like to be able to capture is the values around that boundary. How do I do that? Well, it's node elimination. I need to eliminate nodes inside the graph, very much like Gaussian elimination. The problem is, if there are loops in the graph, eliminating nodes gives you a much denser graph. You get things that aren't directly connected on this boundary, but are now connected because they were connected to something inside. What do you have to do? You have to thin that graph. What does that correspond to? It corresponds to an information projection. Minimizing Kullback-Leibler divergence, in this case, corresponds to solving a constrained maximum entropy problem. So you have an algorithm that basically looks like the algorithms we used on trees. It's exactly a tree model where, in fact, in information form, you're propagating probability distributions, thinning them. And that requires being able to do exact calculations on that probability distribution, so you get something to a point where you have to thin, where you can still do exact calculations, thin it, and then move it, then let it grow. Eventually these things meet, so you've got to combine them. I refer to that as inverse mitosis. You have to join these two things together, have to remove the interior edges and get rid of them. Again, it's a thinning step. At the top, I now have models that correspond to blankets. Everything outside a cavity it's a model right outside the boundary that tells you everything you need to know about everything outside that boundary for things inside. So it's a two-sweep algorithm, exactly the information form of the algorithm used before, with this one additional step of thinning. It introduces an error, but the mixing that goes on in the process of going between steps, in fact, reduces the error, so you can bound the errors in these things. So these things you can think of for sensor networks, where a sensor starts just broadcasting out. And several sensors do this simultaneously, and the information meets. Jason was applying this to image processing, and I asked him, well, why don't you go back to that piece of the Pacific Ocean we did and show that at least you can look at a problem like that. You don't know Jason, but Jason doesn't listen very well. So he didn't do that part of the ocean. He did the entire world and did it in lightning speed. So this is solving a 2.5 million dimensional least squares problems in a minute on a workstation. You can see El Nino. Okay, so that was a very nice piece of work, which Jason is continuing. Let me say a couple of words about something else, which is some work that Jason and another student, Dmitry Malyutov, are starting to look at. And so I'm going to look at Gaussian models, and I'm going to normalize the variables so that the inverse of the covariance has ones along the diagonal. The off-diagonal terms correspond to places where there are edges, because that's the terms that are going to appear in the exponential have to be, the only non-zero terms have to correspond to edges. So it's zero diagonal, and the off-diagonal terms have very interesting interpretations. They're partial correlations. So the strength of that term at a particular edge, ij, is the conditional correlation coefficient between these two variables conditioned on everything else in the rest of the graph. So it tells you how much that edge adds. All right. So what did Jason and Dmitry do? They did something very simple. They said, well, suppose that, in fact, the spectral radius of R is less than 1. In fact, it's slightly stronger than that. They've looked at the absolute value of every element of R made that less than 1. Well, I can write out a power series for this. And what's interesting is you can think about the terms in these power series as walk sums. Each of the terms there corresponds to a path in the graph, possibly repeating, where at each time I multiply by the canonical correlation coefficient, partial correlation coefficient along that path. So I end up with something that looks like a non-commutative power series, formal power series that involves paths in the tree, paths in the graph, excuse me. So you end up with sums of products of elements around all of these paths. Well, belief propagation computes a very easily characterized strict subseries of this. And this led, for the Gaussian problems, to the tightest conditions that are known for convergence of belief propagation. And for me, led to something that I think is really interesting. So you can think of belief propagation as a very interesting distributed dynamic system. Each node sends messages out, gets messages back in, doesn't have to have much memory, sends them back out and back in. So it's a very simple dynamic system that realizes that reduced power series. So all you're doing is remembering the most recent messages. So the full walk sums, in general, for a general graph, require high dimensional memory at each node to keep tracks of things. So the dimensions, in fact, that grow with graph size, bad. But there are a lot of algorithms that, in fact, don't have memory that grows with graph size. Just include one more path at each node. Do other things that are state augmentation. In physics literature, this is referred to as Kikuchi approximations or generalized belief propagation. A really interesting question is, what are the rational subseries? What are the things that I can realize here in this way? Okay, I mentioned this issue of handoff, having something go from one sensor to another. Well, the issue as an object moves. So here's an object being tracked. The triangle is the sensor to whom information is being handed off. It's querying other sensors. We now know there's a cost for communication. Alex Eiler told us how to compute that in terms of the number of bits. The one on the left does not take that into account, so the triangle moves all the time. You're spending a lot of communication energy changing who's in charge. The one on the right uses basically a rollout algorithm for dynamic programming to do that optimally. Okay, so where are we going? Well, in graphical models, we're doing a few things. One of them is that recursive cavity modeling, and I refer to it as plus-plus, but it actually relates to something that David asked yesterday about, which is tying this in with multipole algorithms. One of the problems with, say, the oceanographic problem is that the water near Los Angeles, individual at scales of meters separate, isn't very correlated with information about the water temperature near Tokyo at the same scale. However, if I take averages at particular scales, they are indeed highly correlated. That suggests building what are known as multipole statistical models, something that hasn't been done, to develop algorithms that are, in fact, much faster for these types of problems. I've already mentioned the other one I'm keenly interested in, which is the dynamical system version of the walk, these walk sums. We're also doing things on model estimation. This is one of the places where we're doing things that involve sparse approximations, as you heard about yesterday morning. And there are a variety of applications. There's some interesting ones that I'm just beginning to understand in structural biology, and some things we're doing on fast surface reconstruction and visualization. We were inspired to do this by Shell Oil. We were inspired because they gave us money to do it. So that's why we're doing it. But it's a fascinating problem. Now, what about sensor networks? The way I refer to sensor networks, this is information science in the large. These aren't problems in signal processing. They aren't problems in computing. They aren't problems in information theory. They're all of them. So these take different cuts through the problems, and that's what makes it so exciting. And we've just scratched the surface. There are all sorts of things you can think about. Why does the graph of the statistical process have to be the same as the sensor network? What if Chicken Little had broadcast his message? So Lucy Goosey knew that this was a message that came from Chicken Little already. Suppose you did that. What if you sent more complex messages that had, just like you do in a wireless network, something that tells you where it's been and how it's been fused? So in fact, when the message got to Lucky Ducky, he knew its pedigree as it came around. That uses up bits. We have fewer bits for the message, but we know how to trade off estimation error for number of bits now. Maybe we can put those together. And what if nodes can ask for information? We do this all the time. You say, okay, if you don't call me, here's what I'm going to assume. So in fact, we include some information in the statement that no news is in fact news. Okay, I'm now going to switch gears, and this is the second part of my talk. I think we started a few minutes late, so I think I'll take about 10 minutes for this. This is to talk about some of the people and this place. I thought I needed a title and abstract, but I thought instead of that, I came up with a really great title for this. But it seems somebody else had used this title. For some of those of you who aren't French speaking, that's Close Encounters of the Third Kind. So I'm going to give you three small stories about three encounters. And the first one is one that took place in 1972, and it has a title. And in 1972, I was starting my last year of graduate school, working my PhD under Roger Brockett's supervision. Steve Marcus was at MIT finishing his master's with Jan Willems. Jan had just announced that he was going to be leaving MIT to go back to the University of Groningen. I eventually got his position, but nobody knew that at that time. Steve and I were good friends, and he talked to me about, well, who should he work with? And I said, well, gee, maybe you want to go talk with Roger. About the same time, Roger suggested, since he was at Harvard and I was at MIT, that we arrange a soccer game, what Americans call soccer, what most of the world calls football. And so I arranged a soccer match between the systems and control groups at MIT and Harvard. It's interesting to see some of the people who were there. From Harvard, there was Roger, John Barris, David Dopkin, Tamer Bashar, who was a postdoc at that point, from MIT. I was on the team. Steve was on the team. Sanjoy Mitter. Jan Willems, Keith Glover was on the team, Richard Vinter from Imperial College was on the team, and my colleague at AlphaTech, Neil Sandel, was on the team. Now, the Harvard team had one real advantage. They had several people such as Tom Mayer who had actually played soccer regularly, and that was clearly unfair. But we countered with a couple of our own strengths. One of which is that during the game, we played with anywhere between 11 and 14 people. We figured we were MIT, they were Harvard. It was less likely that they could count that high. The other was we had a number of people who had no idea what soccer was, and that was a great strength. And one of those individuals was Steve Marcus. Steve had just made an appointment, I think, for a week or two after that to go up and talk with Roger about research. Steve, as some of you may know, grew up in Texas. And in Texas, they know what football is, and it's not a game that you just use your feet. It's a different kind of game. So during this match, there came a point in time where there was a loose ball, and Steve and Roger went after it and had their own close encounter. And that's how Steve became my first PhD student, rather than Roger's. Is a great honor. And to have worked with one of the greatest minds in the field was great. Both of them provided me with lots of insights and lots of interesting experiences. And from Roger, I certainly learned what research was all about. With Steve, I can tell you that if you ever need to construct a circuit, a noisy circuit, whose stochastic evolution lives on a solvable Lie group, all you need is a bottle of tequila and Steve Marcus, and you're all set. With Roger, he almost scared me away when he told me that there was the great theorem god in the sky who liked to eat theorems, and it was my job for the rest of my career to keep feeding her theorems so that she would stay happy. I would like to thank both of them for being here. It means a lot to me. The second of the three stories took place in 1980 during my first sabbatical at El Dezess, arranged by Michel Fleiss, and it also has a title. While I was at El Dezess, I had done a lot of consulting for Schlumberger, and I was hired by Chris Clavier at Schlumberger because he wanted somebody to look over the shoulders of these two scientists he'd just given a contract to, Benveniste and Basseville. So he needed somebody to make sure that what they were doing was okay. It turns out that when this is the first time I met Albert and Michel was at Clamart, it turns out they were doing things in an area in which Michel is now the world's expert, detection of abrupt changes. And I had written one paper in this area. And Michel, or Albert, I can't remember who, was going up and explaining things, mostly to Chris, but some to me about what they were doing, and also some things about what I was doing. There came some point in the discussion where I can't remember which of them said something that I didn't think is what was written in my paper. And I said, no, that's not correct. I got up and started doing some things, and immediately one or both of them said, no, that's not correct. And so immediately at that point, I figured either this was going to be a great relationship or it was going to be an absolute disaster. Later on that year, Albert and Michel arranged a small workshop out here. It was my first trip to Brittany, and it was a great small workshop. At the end of that workshop, Susanna, my wife, and her parents were visiting, came out to Brittany, and we were going to go take a trip to the west of Brittany. And I told Albert this. And I told him we were going to go to the Crozon Peninsula. And he said, aha, maybe you'll be lucky and there'll be a big storm. And so my immediate reaction is, boy, he really hates me. Well, there was, and it was spectacular. And that, combined with other things, such as walking with Susanna's father around the fishing port at Concarneau, and other things, made it clear to me this was not going to be our last time in Brittany. And that led to the third piece of this, which is what's happened starting with my sabbatical and going on. As you can see from the work here, the seeds of it came from what happened in my sabbatical here. I've learned, I can't say enough about the relationship I've had with people here, and I've learned a great deal. Some things which aren't technical. I mean, I learned about the concept of a space-time picnic, because in Brittany, if you want to stay in the sun and not in the rain, you need to move. And so I don't think we ever calculated the fractal dimension of any of our picnics, but we moved a lot. I also learned about French humor. Albert, very quickly, when we came here, our younger daughter, Kate, was 2 years old. And Albert noticed that when she was happy, she would stick her tongue out. And so he would make scientific observations. And he'd say, aha, I see that Kate is 2 centimeters happy today. Now, that's clearly French humor, because you'd never say that in the United States. In the United States, you say, aha, I see she's 0.7847 inches happy. And that's not funny. And the third is, I hadn't realized that Albert is such a good artist, so good an artist, that I had Susanna design a T-shirt commemorating the two great artists that I admire in France. So we have Les Arbres de Monet and Les Arbres de Benveniste. I think the similarity is remarkable. The experiences we've had here technically have been phenomenal, and we've also fallen in love with Brittany. And so in closing, the title for this is something Suzanne and I want to say, which is Nous sommes chez nous. Merci.